is Patricia Camilleri. Today we continue with the series The Gospels, a Commentary. I shall be reading selected Gospel passages, which will then be commented by Professor Anthony Frendo, Head of the Department of Arabic and Near Eastern Studies, and Professor Peter Varsalo, Head of the Department of English.
If you understand, or if you don't, if you believe, or if you doubt, there's a universal justice, and the eyes of truth are always watching you.
A reading from John chapter 5, verses 1 to 18. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, there is a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." At once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was a Sabbath, so the Jews said to the man who had been cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your mat." But he answered them, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Take up your mat and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take it up and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had disappeared in the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Do not sin any more, so that nothing worse happens to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Therefore, the Jews started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is still working, and I also am working." For this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father, thereby making himself equal to God.
So, Peter, we've got another text in front of us today. This is the healing of the crippled man by Jesus in one of the pools of Jerusalem. By way of introduction, perhaps we should put this text in its own context, in a very wide context. In fact, I would say the subtitle or a title for today's conversation would be Text and Context. Because the text mentions a pool in Jerusalem, it mentions the name of the pool, There is the narrative, which obviously relates the healing of the paralyzed person by Jesus, and then there is the dialogue between Jesus and the Jews. First of all, the first half of the text we have, namely the narrative section, is subservient to the discourse in this case. The high point, the pitch of the whole section which we've read leads to the dialogue, conversation and confrontation between Jesus and the Jews. Jesus heals on the Sabbath. And these are the two main points, I think. Jesus is the healer, and he does it on the Sabbath, and therefore he drives the Jews crazy about this, as we saw in previous context. Now, there are some problems to clear before we start our conversation. First of all, the name. John says the pool, which in Hebrew is called Bethesda. First of all, when he says in Hebrew, he often means in Aramaic, because Aramaic was the spoken language at the time, but that's no problem. The problem is the name. There is a textual problem here. Different manuscripts give us different names for the pool. We've got Bethesda, 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 and so on and so forth. The version we've read opts for Bethesda, which is the more difficult reading, which, as you know better than I do, in textual criticism, is the one to be preferred. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole problem is, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. Well, Bethesda in Aramaic probably means the House of Olives. But the main point is this, that in Jerusalem there were many, many pools, and Bethesda is one of them. Another probable reading could be Bethesda, not to be confused with Bethsaida, Bethesda. And Bethesda in Hebrew and Aramaic could mean either of two things: the house of mercy, or the house of pools, the house of the pools. And a similar name has been found in the Qumran documents. The third thing to note is that excavations have been conducted in this area, in front of St. Anne's Church in Jerusalem, and lo and behold, the remnants of two pools with porticos have been found. And archaeologists are not completely, let's say, all in agreement, but the mainstream opinion is that, or let's say one of the main mainstream opinions is that this area which John is referring to is nowadays to be found to the north of the Temple Mount in front of St. Anne's Church. Now, there was a temple in Greco-Roman times, and therefore also in the time of Jesus, dedicated to Asclepius, who was the Greek god of healing.
Healing medicine, yeah.
And therefore Jesus is saying, it's not Asclepius who's the healer, I heal you. Mm-hmm. This just by way of introduction, we can then continue our conversation.
As we know, we've actually been on site to Jerusalem, and we've seen the excavations and the porches, which would seem to authenticate the place. But there are some things that puzzle me a bit. For example, you've got a man who is terribly disabled, who is lying down on a kind of mat, who is too weak to get up and get into the water, and you have an interpretation of an event which is not quite saying what the event was, but interpreting that at a point in time, an angel of the Lord, at a certain season, went down and stirred the pool a bit, and it had this miraculous power, which is very strange, because this is water which cleanses of infirmities, and is poor. Man was waiting to try to get his time into it, and of course it was a matter of first come, first served.
Exactly.
And the angel of the Lord has in fact done something to it. This is of course the way it's being interpreted.
Exactly.
It may have had miraculous powers, but why at one time of the year and not another is still a mystery. And so he of course never gets a chance to get in, and of course Christ is healing a man who hasn't yet asked to be healed. In most of the others, it always is, Jesus, Son of David, please heal me. They plead with him. They ask, please have mercy. If you have compassion, please look at me and look at the way I am. And I'm a leper. Please help me out. I've been a miserable life. words of, to that effect. But here, Christ himself goes up to him and says, do you want to be healed?
This is a very important point, Peter, I think, which you're making, because it's obviously we're in John's Gospel, which is much more reflective and, in a sense, deeper than the other Gospels, not in the sense that it reflects a lot on the events. I think the initiative here is taken by Jesus because it is a text which wants to underscore the self-revelation of Jesus. The whole question of the text, as the crescendo goes up towards the end, is who is Jesus? And therefore, the initiative, do you want to be made well, is underlining the fact that, as you correctly say, in this context, it is not the crippled man who is asking. He hasn't even seen Jesus yet. Jesus comes up, and he's offering his services, so to say. He's making himself available, revealing himself as the healer par excellence. In a pool which was dedicated probably to Asclepius, he's saying, I am the one. Do you want to be healed?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so it's a question of self-revelation. Let's say, theologians would say it's the revelation of the divine, you know. Jesus is saying who he is.
Yeah. But again, Jesus doesn't quite tell, I think, doesn't quite say who he is. He is healing him, and he is an unknown healer.
Exactly.
And later on, when this man is totally healed and gets up and is amazed by his recovery, and Jesus meets him later in the temple, says, now you're healed, aren't you? Presumably, aren't you the one I've healed before?
Exactly.
Now, why should Jesus say this, if not perhaps to want now to reveal his identity?
He does it gradually.
He does it gradually.
First the event,
yes.
Then the dialogue.
Yes.
And so to say, the man was happy that he was healed. He didn't even know who Jesus was. But then he gets him, he corners him, so to say, and there he actually unfolds what was actually happening.
But this brings us to a second difficulty. As somebody who reads the Bible as a literary text. And the second difficulty is, you see, if you read it as a literary text, you read it with a kind of inquiring mind. If you read it as a theologian would read it, sometimes you're carried away by the fact that it's Jesus and somehow all right and righteousness is always on his side. So you have to distance yourself. Now, if you defamiliarize it, you notice that, I think here, this man, who's been healed, seems to tell Jesus, Jesus is proclaiming his identity. But again, why does Jesus really say, this is the crux, you are the man I made whole, sin no more, lest a worse thing will happen to you.
Mm.
Now, if there's a man who is totally disabled, can hardly move, one has to say, I mean, from the human point of view, what possible sins could he have committed?
Exactly. This is obviously the crux, because at first sight, I think the text, could be misunderstood in this sense, that one could link the man's being crippled with having sinned. Whereas Jesus is, I think, driving him on two levels, the physical and the spiritual. And he says, see, you have been made well, do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse happens to you. So he is first stating, in a sense, what is now obvious, that the man has been physically healed. And he's telling him to inquire after a healing which is not physical, but spiritual. In other words, he's telling him, just as you have been made whole by me on the physical level, now you need something else.
Yes, but don't you think that Jesus' comment, when he says, sin no more, lest something worse will happen to you,
exactly,
is an indirect way of linking the Redeemer, the man who is physically the doctor, the physician, who has cured the man, with the spiritual physician. There's the two aspects of the physician.
Uh-huh.
Christ is the healer, the physician, and it makes it's rather puzzling to see that here you have this man who's really beginning to realize that this must be the Christ who linked sin with healing. Earlier on, you have another bit, a phrase which says, which is the best for me to do? Tell you thy sins are forgiven, or get up and rise.
There's the parallel passage.
Parallel passage. The linking at the two levels would make the other man think this is the Christ, and he goes about and says it,
and he will make him seek for the
and make him
healing.
Seek and also proclaim him.
Exactly. The only snag here is that it could. I don't think it was actually, but because I think what you've said actually hits the nail on the head. At first sight, the text could be misunderstood as if Jesus were linking physical ailment with sin. That's not his statement. I think his statement is what you have just said, and the ambiguity is cleared because of a later text in John when Jesus heals a blind man. And the disciples ask, who has sinned, he or his parents? And he says none of them. In other words, he's saying, don't link physical ailment with sin. But I think here he's saying something different. He's saying what you have just said. He wants to lead the man from the physical sphere to the spiritual sphere. Mm-hmm. He has offered healing. Jesus has taken the initiative to heal him physically. But he wants to lead him on, so that the man will now ask for another type of healing. And he does it, as you say. He practically believes in Jesus in the end.
Yes.
I mean, he
sort of proclaims him.
Yeah.
He goes along and says it was Jesus who did this.
And then we've got the problem of the dialogue with the Jews here. My father is still working and I am also working.
Yes.
So he's, I am the Lord of the Sabbath.
He is almost provoking them here.
Yes.
He's provoking them because he's doing something, let us say, a deed on the Sabbath. And that for them was, the Sabbath was sacrosanct. And you couldn't even do good because it was just no work at all. Again, the totally literal interpretation without the spirit of the law. Just the words of the law, the diktat of the law. And the other is that you have, in a sense, almost an antagonistic, he's always provoking an antagonism by saying, I'm doing the work of my father. Now, which really means, my father is God.
Exactly.
And he's proclaiming indirectly, again, the fact that he's the Son of God, which enrages them and infuriates them.
This is correct, because every day they used to recite the Jewish prayer of the Shema, taken from the book of Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel, there is one God.
Yeah.
And in a sense, he's provoking them, because here they are proclaiming daily, saying the daily prayer, there is none but one God. And he's talking of Father and Son. He's introducing this new level.
And I see him as a dangerous, subversive man who must be eliminated at all costs.
Exactly.
And they, in fact, plan to kill him. This is one of the first instances when we're told that they hoped, they sought to slay him.
All the more to kill him.
The more to kill him.
And in John, this is a current theme, that they grasped, in a sense, the antagonists of Jesus grasped what he was trying to say, and they couldn't digest it. In other words, they weren't. The problem is, I think, that they. It is true. One should sympathize at first with them in the sense that they had been brought up in a certain way. They had their traditions. But Jesus was producing evidence to embellish and magnify that tradition and refine it. And this is what they were not open to. In a sense, I would say it is an intellectual obtuseness. They are not open to the evidence. They don't want to look at the evidence.
They don't want because it disturbs them.
This is it.
It disturbs them.
So it's spiritual
so
at the same time.
So they're picking on the rule of the law of Moses, you should do nothing on a Sabbath day, because God himself, as it were, rested. And picking on that in order to use that as a pretext.
It is a pretext. To get him out of the way.
And they are really turning good into a kind of evil, aren't they? Because
he's a man and they accuse him.
And, of course, we see this later on. It happens again and again.
And the passion also.
And the passion.
And one point which you've mentioned is actually one should say here that in John's Gospel, for example, in this passage which we're discussing, there is already what some people have called an elemental Trinitarian theology, which is true. John is not a council of the church. He's not the later council of Ephesus or council of Chalcedon or whatever. But John is already studying with openness the events of the life of Jesus Christ. And he has to come to the conclusion that there is no other conclusion except that this is God himself. And therefore, this is revolutionary, obviously, because there is one God. So how can you say Father and Son? And this is the beginning of what would later become the Trinitarian theology, that there is one God, but of his own essence, he is love, relationship, and not a monad, if you see what I mean.
Yes, but and it's also intriguing to see that from now on, Jesus will almost detach himself from his family, even when they come to see him.
Yes.
And he sees,
who are my father, my mother, and my sister?
Yes, my father, who are they, except the people here? He's taken on another identity, as it were.
Exactly.
He's no longer Mary's son, but he is the Son of God.
He goes beyond that. I'm recalling one interesting comment you've made a short while ago, Peter, about the angels steering the water. Actually, it's interesting that you made your observation from the literary point of view, and you're supported, if I may say so, completely by textual criticism here. Because that verse where it says that the angel used to come and stir up the water and so on and so forth seems to be, from the textual point of view, a later addition. To the text, like a gloss, so to say, which was inserted to try and interpret what in fact was something physical, namely, the water used to rush from one pool to the other. These were two pools which were interconnected by pipes, and every so often, intermittent water used to flow with a rush. Now, this physical event, which is purely hydraulics, if I may say so, has been interpreted by some later glossator as an angel steering the water.
It's a gloss on
which
thing.
Is interesting, because it shows you that it is true that there was the pool with an onrush of water, that people used to believe that they were healed there, and Jesus does it precisely in this context. And mentioning context, there's another instance in the Gospels which is analogous to this. Here we... archaeology comes to our rescue, so to say. It gives us the broad context of the text, that there is a healing by Jesus in the temple of Asclepius, in a pool dedicated to Asclepius. Elsewhere in another gospel, when Jesus asks them, who do you say that I am? And they say, you are this Messiah, the Son of God. At Caesarea Philippi, where there was, in a nearby watery place, a cavern with statues of Roman and Greek gods. So for the second time, Jesus does it. He reveals himself in a pagan Greco-Roman context, physically so. He takes the context and goes beyond it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
He takes his own times. He reads his own times. He's a son of his own period. And yet he goes beyond and speaks to people who can understand that language. They know who Asclepius was. They know who the Greek and Roman gods were. And he's, in a sense, giving it to them on a plate. I think... then this phrase, the man who, he says, take your mat and walk, is identical to another event narrated in the Gospel of Mark. Take your when they lower the bed to the ceiling,
and he's struck by their faith and all the trouble they go
to. And there is an analogy here.
There's an analogy.
The only thing is that John puts it on the Sabbath and gets underlines the fact that this is a Sabbath, and we come to the climax with the Jews. Interesting in verse 18 that the Jews started persecuting Jesus. As you say, simply because he healed somebody. The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Obviously, in the context, they knew that Jesus was working, to use his own phrase.
That he had these extraordinary powers.
Exactly.
But remember, of course, they are so puzzled by this power, this force, that they sometimes ascribe it to the devil.
That
and then
it.
The marvelous answer, how can the devil cast out the devil
in the name of the devil?
In the name of the devil. A kingdom divided among itself would not last.
This is it.
Yes.
And it just goes to show that it could be ambiguous, but it depends on one's heart on how to receive this self-revelation of Jesus.
Yes.
Or if you believe, or if you doubt.